Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Calls for an end to racial injustice and race-based discrimination are growing louder, and many of the proposed solutions focus on changes to the way state and local police departments operate. Today on The Exchange, a conversation with representatives of the police, the NAACP, and Black Lives Matter on the way forward. And we'd love to hear from you on this. Changes, if any, would you most like to see to policing in New Hampshire? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Let's start the show today by getting caught up with a few notable efforts in police reform at the national level. And for this, we turn to Ellen Nilsen, political reporter with Vox News. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with President Trump's executive order on police reform. How does this address issues of race in police, and what's been the response?
Yeah, absolutely. So President Trump released his new executive order yesterday. And basically, it does a few things. Notably, it creates a misconduct database that the Justice Department would create a national database to track misconduct by police officers, with sort of the idea being that because of how sometimes things are handled by police unions, if there is, you know, a bad actor in a police department, that they can sort of easily go on to another police department and get another job, even if they've been disciplined, without anybody sort of really knowing what their history is. And so this is an idea that is in, I would say, all of, you know, Trump's proposal, House Democrats' proposal, and also Senate Republicans' forthcoming proposal. The other thing that Trump is trying to do is basically try to incentivize, you know, police departments to do things like, you know, racial bias training and, you know, credentialing, making sure that they have credentials certifying that they meet certain training standards, and sort of tying Department of Justice grants to whether police departments have done certain training.
Mm-hmm. And Democrats in Congress have been working on police reform, a bill called the Justice and Policing Act. This is a big piece of legislation. What are some of the most ambitious aspects of this bill?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that where Democrats want to go, I mean, there's so much in this legislation. I think that the biggest thing that is sort of a sticking point right now between the GOP and Democrats is something that Democrats have in their bill that would change a thing called qualified immunity, which courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have interpreted to give police officers and other public officials pretty broad immunity from being sued if they've violated the constitutional rights of an individual, whether that is, you know, destroying somebody's property in the process of serving a warrant, or, you know, a violent act, or, you know, death against killing somebody in process of, you know, doing their job. Obviously, right now, the way that the law is set up, there is a very high standard that prosecutors have to demonstrate if they are to successfully prosecute a police officer. They have to demonstrate that there was willful intent to harm somebody on the part of the officer, which can be really tough to do. And qualified immunity, a lot of times, just kind of robs people of the ability to try to sue, you know, a police officer if they have had property damage or loss of life of a loved one or other things. And so Democrats are trying to, you know, change the law here. And the GOP has basically said if they want to do a bipartisan bill, that is a non-starter.
I see. And so overall, though, how would local police departments be affected if it were to pass?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is a tricky question, no matter if you're sort of on Trump's side of things or going as far as House Democrats want to go. I mean, basically, the federal government and Congress can change federal law and can, you know, really bring the hammer down on federal police. But as far as state and local police, like we have, you know, in New Hampshire, basically what they can do is they can tie incentives or, you know, tie new requirements to grant funding and to federal money that goes out to state police departments and local police departments. But they can't necessarily mandate these changes because, you know, states and municipalities have kind of broad leeway in setting their own laws and setting rules and regulations. So basically, you know, both the House Democrat bill and what Trump is saying and what Senate Republicans are saying, you know, the House Democrats can tell federal police what to do if the bill were to pass and be signed into law, but they can't necessarily tell state and local police what to do.
I see. So sort of an incentive system that the federal government can pass for local departments. But there are calls to defund the police, to shift priorities in order to better address systemic racism. How have Democrats responded to this call?
I think that House Democrats and House leadership in particular are sort of trying to walk this fine line between embracing that, you know, that thing that activists, you know, really would like them to wholeheartedly embrace. And basically what the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Karen Bass, when Democrats were unveiling the bill recently, basically said there is no new money for police departments in House Democrats' bill. And the bill does also contain grant money for local communities to sort of, as she put it, re-envision what policing might look like. And so I think that, you know, House Democrats are sort of trying to do the same thing that activists are trying to do as in regards to basically putting more money towards mental health services or domestic violence services, so that police, you know, don't necessarily have to respond to all of these things, but they are not actively drawing money away from police departments. So I definitely think that Nancy Pelosi and House leadership is not there yet on defund the police. And I think that especially in an election year, they're sort of trying to walk a fine line on this.
Mm-hmm. And so we've talked about the House, but what about the Senate? Republicans are also working on these issues. They're in control in the Senate. What's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a kind of a flurry of activity in D.C. today on both sides. So House Democrats are marking up the Justice and Policing Act. And over in the Senate, Republicans are set to unveil their own bill, which Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina has sort of been leading the charge on this bill. And I think that broadly, it sort of looks a lot like what Trump has been doing there. You know, again, is sort of this incentive to a local police department to, you know, to do more bias training and to, you know, do different standards training and things like that. But again, it's not as forceful as House Democrats' bill. There is nothing with qualified immunity. And I think that even though it sounds like Tim Scott really wants Republicans to act on this swiftly, and I should note that he's the only Black Republican in the Senate. I don't think that Republican leaders in the Senate have said that they probably won't take this bill up until later in July, after the July 4th recess. So it could be some time until we see Republicans pass their own bill, which could make it even longer potentially for Republicans and Democrats to come together and maybe hammer out a compromise.
So, Ella, overall, where is there agreement? Is there agreement on issues of increased support for people experiencing mental health issues so that they don't have to interact with police in the first place? Where is there agreement?
Yeah, I would say that there is agreement in this this idea of a national database for tracking police misconduct. There is agreement broadly in, you know, boosting funding for mental health services. But I think that especially when it comes to boosting funding for you know, mental health services, domestic violence services, I think that there's a difference between what Trump was sort of saying yesterday, which was just like, you know, we should do these things rather than specifying, you know, how much money you would want to actually put to these things. I think that there is much broader disagreement on changes to the law itself as far as qualified immunity or willful misconduct goes. I think that, you know, maybe Democrats and Republicans can hammer out a compromise, but at the same time, you know, this is a really highly charged issue. It's an election year. We have seen, you know, widespread protests around the country, not just in cities, but also in smaller states and towns and cities. So, you know, I think that Democrats are seeing this and they really want to make sure that they are kind of meeting the demands of people in communities that have been impacted by this for years. They don't necessarily want to pass a watered down bill, but at the same time, you know, the GOP controls the Senate. So there needs to be some sort of compromise that is reached if something is going to pass.
Well, Ella Nilsen, politics reporter with Vox News, thank you very much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, we're talking about policing in New Hampshire and possible changes to come. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. I want to bring in a trio of guests who will be with us for the rest of the hour today. James McKim, president of the Manchester chapter of the NAACP. Erica Perez, co-founder of the Manchester chapter of Black Lives Matter, and Chief Charlie Dennis, Chief of Hanover Police and President of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. Thank you all very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd love to give you all a chance really quickly to respond to a little bit of what you may have just heard with Ella Nilsen about moves in Congress, the Justice and Policing Act, also President Trump's executive order. We'll start with you, James. What do you make of any of that?
Well, it's really heartening to see the action that's taking place at the in Congress at the federal level. And there's some really, really good and needed suggestions and proposals on the table. And you know, it's really interesting to think about the great question you asked about what impact those federal level laws and changes would have at the state level. And we really, you know, need to do from our legislative perspective, and in New Hampshire, many of the same changes, modifications, we need to make them into state laws and whatnot. So that was one of the media reactions here for me.
Erica Perez, Black Lives Matter. What do you think?
Can you just repeat the question one more time?
Forgive me if it's a super broad question, but I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to a little bit of the news that Ella Nilsen summarized for us regarding President Trump's executive order on police reform or what's been happening in Congress with the Justice and Policing Act. Responses to any of those, if you have one.
I would say that my response to it is that I do also agree with James McKim that it's nice to see that they're finally talking about it, taking it seriously, trying to get legislation passed. But I also think that they're dragging it out on purpose, that we really like might not get it through, and that they don't understand that nothing that they want to end that's going on in this country will end until they pass the proper legislation. This isn't something they can put off.
Mm-hmm. And Chief Charlie Dennis, your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. And I think as the other two panelists agreed too, it's I think it's good to see conversations occurring not only at the national level, but also at the state level and also within our local community level. So all three of those areas are having those conversations, and some of those are difficult conversations. But I think it's through those difficult conversations that good change can come forward. So I look at it as a good starting point.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's bring it down to the local level and respond to something that we all learned about yesterday, which is that Governor Chris Sununu announced the creation of the New Hampshire Commission on Law Enforcement, Accountability, Community and Transparency. I'd like to hear from each of you on what you'd like to see come out of this commission. And let's start with you, Chief Dennis, since you're on this commission.
Well, I think it's a great opportunity. The makeup of the committee is broad and bring in a lot of people from the community, different organizations, law enforcement also, judicial system, attorney general's office. So I think that's a great broad group to have at the table to start these discussions. And there are some good changes that law enforcement can make. And I don't think there's a law enforcement chief out there that wants to make good, positive change and do the right thing so that we can uphold our ethics and our duty to protect and serve and keep people safe at the same time. So I think it's a great opportunity for us all to come together, have those conversations, and come forward with some good, productive changes.
Mm-hmm. And I'll dig into what you think those changes should be in a little bit, Chief Dennis, but I do want to hear also from James McKim of the Manchester NAACP, because James, you are also on this commission.
Yes, I am. And so the chief and I are going to be spending some time together on the commission. And I agree, it's such a great opportunity to start the conversation, and continue the conversation, but bring people together who've not really been together in the conversation. And that's unique. And I really want to give kudos to the governor for taking this initiative. There are so many areas that we can discuss, and the chief is right. There really isn't a chief or a leadership of the police at state level and the county and the local level who don't want to improve the way that policing is done and really ensure that what's happened in Minneapolis and in Kentucky and in Atlanta do not happen here.
Mm-hmm. And Erica, what would you hope would come out of this new commission? I believe the governor was asked about whether someone from Black Lives Matter was on the commission during his press conference yesterday. He wasn't sure at the time, but as far as I know, he may have reached out to Black Lives Matter afterwards. I don't know if you know anything about that.
Yeah, I do, actually. First, I just want to congratulate the other co-founder of Black Lives Matter Manchester, Rennell, for making it onto the commission. And secondly, I just want to say that I am really happy with the fact that there is going to be a commission, because I know that BLM Manchester will collaborate and come up with suggestions and bring them forward. But I am a little bit disappointed. I know that, we're congratulating the diversity on the commission itself. I do think it's a little bit law enforcement heavy for something that's supposed to affect the community. So I think there could have been a few more community members, a few more members of people dealing who deal with mental health, things that people have been bringing forward as things that we need. I feel like more people from the community who are affected by the things that are happening should have been asked to be a part of it. But that's just my personal opinion. I think that it would have made it just that little bit better, a little bit more trustworthy in people's eyes, if that makes sense.
Fewer members of law enforcement, more members of the community, in your view, Erica?
Yeah, just in my view. I do understand, I think it's really important that, all the people that are appointed are a part of it, but I think that it could have had more members of the community. So not saying that they need to have less law enforcement, but more members of the community being able to speak also.
I see. So maybe not just, replacing seats at the table, but expanding the table.
Exactly. Expanding the table to make more room for people like activists and for people who are a part of mental health or deal with people with addiction problems, things that are a problem in our state.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Tyrell in Manchester. Thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to discuss. One moment. Sorry, I forgot my thought. It's been a while. I've been waiting. So I wanted to discuss divestment in the police department and reinvestment into schools, okay? People have no misunderstanding when we ask for people to divest in the schools. But when we mention defunding the police, it becomes a catch-all term that scares everybody. But what we're really asking for is the divestment of that money into school systems, so schools can afford paper and proper learning and laptops for their students. I believe the police shouldn't have military weapons. And I do believe that that's something that we should look into. I also wanted to discuss the immunity part. I believe that a lot of politicians who are against
qualified immunity, was it?
Qualified immunity. Yeah. A lot of politicians that are against qualified immunity are scared that if they the police lose qualified immunity, then those politicians may also lose qualified immunity. And that's something that should be highlighted in the conversation.
Well, Tyrell, you've opened up a lot of subject matter that we are going to discuss. We're going to talk about what it means to defund the police later in the program. Listeners, of course, you're welcome to weigh in on this as well. We'll put you in the queue and bring you into the conversation when that starts. But I'll get your thoughts, Chief Dennis, on qualified immunity before we go to break. What do you make of the push to get rid of qualified immunity? How would that change the way police do their jobs in New Hampshire, in your view?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the loss of that protection could have a profoundly chilling effect on law enforcement officers and limit their ability and willingness to respond to critical incidents without hesitation. I mean, we are asked to respond to incidents without pause and make those split-second decisions and have to rely on the current state of the law in making those decisions. And that qualified immunity helps us do that. I'm not saying maybe there's things that can be looked at, but it would have a profound effect on how we do our jobs.
Mm-hmm. I think that those who are pushing for qualified immunity, the end to it, would agree that it would have a profound effect, but it might be a positive effect in their view. Rather than say too much more, I want to ask James McKim to weigh in on this.
Sure. So it's interesting. We tend to be an all versus nothing mode here. And we hear the phrase defund the police and we immediately think of totally get rid of the police. And I don't think, based on discussions I've been in, the push is not to totally get rid of the police. The issue is to really examine the funding structure and identify where the money should go. When you're talking about qualified immunity, the phrase is get rid of qualified immunity. Well, it was put there for a reason. Let's not sloganize it much, but let's say, so what's the best way to ensure that police have the protections that they need and yet still allow for charging of those and correct adjudication of those who are misconducting themselves? So it's the either or discussion, I think, is what trips us up.
Mm-hmm. Does qualified immunity eliminate, James, in your view, the ability to take a look at what police have done and figure out whether or not they should be liable?
This is a point where I'm not as steeped in exactly the policy and how it's implemented. I think the chief could probably speak better to that question.
Please do, Chief.
Okay, Peter. So certainly qualified immunity provides police officers with protection from civil lawsuits, So long as their conduct does not violate clearly established law or constitutional rights, or that which a reasonable officer would have known. It also doesn't prevent civilians from recovering damages from police officers who knowingly violate an individual's constitutional rights. And certainly if someone's charged with a crime, they're gonna be prosecuted through the criminal justice system too. So there, you can still, even with qualified immunity, you can still be sued. You can still go through federal court for 1983, civil rights violations. All those things are still there.
So even with qualified immunity, you're saying that there are protections for the average citizen so that their rights are not unfairly violated?
Yes, there's just probably a certain standard, and I think that's the conversation that's occurring of where is that standard? Mm-hmm. I mean, if someone puts handcuffs on and someone says they're too tight, I'm going to sue you. I mean, there's finding that balance to that.
I see. Okay. Well, we can see very easily how complicated these questions can get. Listeners, we're speaking today about police practices, and coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about training and how and whether it should change. We'd love to hear from you about this and about anything else related to police conduct in New Hampshire. Give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy, and we will be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
Tomorrow on The Exchange, a look at New Hampshire state parks in the age of the coronavirus. Right now, we're talking about police reform in New Hampshire with members of law enforcement and activist communities. With me on the program today, Erica Perez, co-founder of the Manchester chapter of Black Lives Matter, James McKim, president of the Manchester chapter of the NAACP, and Charlie Dennis, chief of Hanover Police and president of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. Listeners, we'll be talking in this part of the program about police training and oversight. What changes in training would you like to see? What kind of oversight do you think is necessary? Email exchange at nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. We get this note from Tom in Hudson who says, I understand that there may be national certification that police departments and even individual officers can get. Are these required in New Hampshire? And if not, to what extent are they used in New Hampshire voluntarily? That's the question from Tom in Hudson. And Chief Charlie Dennis, seems like it would best be put to you.
Thank you, Peter. Certainly each state has their own rules and regulations that they follow for certifications. I'm not really familiar much from the national footprint that would do that. Every state's a little bit different, although they're very similar in a lot of ways. But you can also see from the differences of Minnesota to here, there's different policies that exist here. But certainly it's more of a state-to-state level of the requirements, especially when it comes to training and different things like that in curriculum.
Mm-hmm. And so is there a way for you to give us sort of the cliff notes on what kind of training police in New Hampshire are required to have?
Certainly. I mean, you start at that recruit level of going in and learning the different RSAs, the laws, the constitutional laws, certainly how to respond to calls for service. 16 weeks is what the New Hampshire Police Academy currently is right now. And it's a broad range of curriculum and subjects to building the foundation for an officer then to graduate, go to their own department, and generally they go through another 12 weeks of field training, of taking that basic information, no different than you go to college or high school or something to learn that foundation of education, and then go out to the field, and how do you apply that?
So those 16 weeks of education, is that on top of a required or requirement for either an associate's or a bachelor's degree, or can someone right out of high school take those 16 weeks and become a police officer?
Generally speaking, most law enforcement officers are 21 or older, and it depends on the agency. Some agencies may require a bachelor's degree. Some may require just a high school diploma or a GED. So it varies from agency to agency all across the United States.
Mm-hmm. And are there any changes to this kind of system, all we've been discussing in the past few minutes, that you would recommend, Charlie Dennis?
Well, certainly I think training is a big issue that's been talked about, just looking at the incident in Minneapolis and the policy of that allowed that officer to, even at the first point, to even use that type of a force. So certainly there needs to be better training in use of force, the appropriate use of force, de-escalation, implicit bias training, I think could be increased. And there should be a national standard, I think, that speaks to that and the amount. And it's critical that this is ongoing. This isn't a take it one time, take a 2-hour or 4-hour class and check the box. This has to be ongoing, quality, good training and education. It's only through that things can start to change, but it has to be ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Erica Perez of Black Lives Matter, what do you make of what Chief Charlie Dennis had to say? A variety of things he suggested.
Honestly, I would love to circle back to the qualified immunity thing because I didn't really get to speak on
certainly.
It, but I did have a thought. Yeah, absolutely. So with absolutely all due respect to the chief and the other people on the call, I think that it's been shown again and again and again and again, especially in this past month when we all have our eyes on it. But it's Black people are dying in their home. No one has been arrested for the death of Breonna Taylor when clearly they were wrong to not identify themselves, to come into her home, to kill her. And then the only person that was initially charged was her boyfriend, who was shooting back with a firearm that he had legally. two intruders to his home, and then the charges were later dropped because of all the backlash. But what I'm saying is, if it's a question of autonomy and your own body, I don't think that qualified immunity should be like included in that, because it's someone else's body. Property is one thing. If you destroy my mailbox on your way to get me because I did something wrong, it's a mailbox. But if you kill me on your way to like arrest me, then that's not okay. It's not okay that we've seen that people aren't being prosecuted, that people aren't being charged, that people aren't going through in the judicial system. They fundraise the officer who killed George Floyd out of jail. It's just the system is not working in our favor. And as far as the implicit bias training, the police officer that killed Rayshard Brooks at the Wendy's had just taken an implicit bias training 2 months ago. So I don't mean to be negative here, but it's heartbreaking because every day all these people are dying and I want to come up with solutions, but it just doesn't seem like it's enough. And honestly, personally, I've seen ads for Manchester Police Department officers on Indeed when I was looking for a job, and it said no experience needed. So that's just how I feel about it.
Mm-hmm. No, a lot to unpack there, certainly. So since we went back to the qualified immunity question, Chief Dennis, can you respond to Erica Perez's comments on qualified immunity?
Well, I mean, certainly we don't know all the instances of every incident. In other words, we don't have ready access to every case and all the details within those investigations. I can certainly understand the outrage and anger that people have about some of these ones. And I think certainly even law enforcement, we cringe when we see some of these things on videos and different things that are out there. But, you know, again, I think James kind of summed it up well. It's not saying that there can't be talks around this and look at that, but just getting away and totally abolishing it, I think would have severe consequences.
Is there something about qualified immunity right now, Chief Dennis, that gives some officers, rightly or wrongly, the feeling that they have permission to act in perhaps a less careful way than those they are trying to serve would want them to behave?
I don't feel that way. And maybe I'm speaking of how I operate personally and as a law enforcement officer. I don't feel that way. Are there ones that could feel that way? There could be.
James McKim, you've been quiet on this, but I'd like to give you a chance to say something.
Sure, thanks. So I think one of the interesting dynamics here is in terms of qualified immunity, one of the points that's discussed is whether the officer fears for their life. And what we've seen is that we know that people of color, Black men particularly, are implicitly viewed as dangerous. So in some cases, police officers and police officers are people. So someone walking down the street and seeing a Black man coming toward them, an immediate reaction could be fear for life. And if you're an officer in a situation where you're responsible for somehow interacting with a Black male, there's a potential for someone to feel like they're fearing for their life in that situation, and they can take actions because of that fear. So this is where, again, as you said, Peter, it's really complicated how to deal with the standard. What's the standard, and what are the interpersonal dynamics that play into that standard?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to circle back to you, Erica, because you had mentioned that, at least in that one case you mentioned, the implicit bias training was ineffective. And then James McKim spelling out how there is sometimes a bias associated with people feeling afraid of Black men. What would you recommend by way of training for police officers to address that issue? Is there something that you could recommend?
Honestly, I'm fully in support of the idea that police officers don't respond to every call, because I don't think, I honestly feel like the police officers are being spread thin and that they're showing up to things that like maybe they don't know how to handle, that maybe a different kind of professional could handle better. And that's just like, in my opinion, when it comes to like mental health, when it comes to drug abuse, it's like it, when someone is homeless and sleeping on Elm Street and they're high and they're coming into a restaurant, like, does that person like get sent away? Does that person get help, or do they get put into Valley Street? And that's like just what I'm trying to say. And also I just like, I want to just bring up the fact that like those split second decisions that like everyone's always talking about, how police officers have to make those split second decisions. Surgeons also have to make split second decisions to save somebody's life. And they are held legally accountable if they do something that kills somebody because they decided that that's what they needed to do, if that wasn't the right thing to do. So I'm not, I wanted to bring up the fact that I never said abolish the police, because often with the name Black Lives Matter Manchester, they see the Black Lives Matter and they assume that I'm always talking about abolishing the police, that I don't want the police, that I want to get rid of the police. And I just want to say that I haven't said that.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on this conversation, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to the phones and talk to Ruth in Alton. Ruth, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
I wanted to know if there are mechanisms in place to encourage officers, and make it a major part of their training, to report instances of abuse by other officers, and to test them on it, put them in situations where they see an officer committing violations. What do they do? What should they do? Make their allegiance primarily with the community.
Okay, Ruth, sorry about the quality of the phone line, but I think we get your question. It seems like a good one for Chief Charlie Dennis. Ruth's question about, is there a chance for, are there mechanisms in place for officers to report misconduct by other officers in New Hampshire?
Yes, and that would be, you know, policies put in place by the local law enforcement agencies. We have one under our rules and regulations of a duty to report misconduct. But, you know, it's interesting, and this is how where things come up. Good things can come out of this. In review of our policy, even though we had a clear reporting of misconduct, and it's expected if you saw someone doing excessive force that you would intervene and do that, it wasn't clearly stated. So I've already made a special order effective immediately that there was a clear duty to intervene, not only report, but also to intervene in that. So there's some good things that come from these conversations of us coming back, looking, thinking we've said it one way, and then we'll look and say, you know what, I think we can say it better and more clearly. I do think in part of her question, you know, it's one thing to say it and put it in policy, but are you really training your people? And this was another opportunity I had. I've received information about a course that was started in New Orleans called Ethical Policing is Courageous, and it's about peer intervention. It's a two-day course, again, teaching officers how to intervene, whether it's the chief using excessive force, their field training officer, their sergeant, where they feel comfortable going through those scenarios, not someone just telling you, you have a duty to intervene. You're actually practicing those roles, which I think will help play out when you're in the field in the middle of those type of situations. Mm-hmm. So there's some good things that are coming from this.
The duty to intervene. Chief Dennis, according to a 2018 nationwide ACLU report that detailed disparities in police enforcement of marijuana laws, blacks in New Hampshire were many times more likely to be arrested for marijuana-related crimes. The union leader reported on this, writing that the ratio, which was slightly higher than the country overall, placed New Hampshire 16th among the 50 states and the District of Columbia, tied with Alabama. And it concluded that racial profiling among law enforcement is directly to blame for these disparities. Minor offenses, including marijuana possession, are aggressively enforced in communities of color, while these same offenses are rarely enforced in more affluent, predominantly white communities. What's your response to this?
Well, I don't remember seeing the article, but certainly I think that's the importance of us having fair and impartial policing policies, bias-based policing, making sure we're training our officers the difference of criminal profiling, and making sure we're not doing that racial type profiling and different things like that. And it's something that law enforcement has to make sure that we're tracking, keeping data up to ensure that we are doing it the right way.
Mm-hmm. Erica Perez and James McKim, have you heard that racial profiling is a major problem here in New Hampshire? Sorry, maybe we'll start with you, James. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was going to say.
Starting with him.
No, go ahead, Erica. I'll let you go first.
Okay, so I actually love this question because I do have statistics. They are a little bit old. They are from 2014, but the likelihood of being arrested compared to a white person in Hillsborough County goes up 2.8%, 2.8 times more likely if you're Black, 2.8 times more likely in all of New Hampshire if you're Black, and then in the United States, it's 2.3 times more likely that you're arrested compared to a white person. And then the likelihood of being jailed compared to a white person in Hillsborough County is 5.8 times more likely than a white person if you're Black. And in all of New Hampshire, it's 5.2 times more likely. So it's not just a question of, oh, like, do you see anything? It's like, no, absolutely. Like, it's a fact that people are being racially profiled in their own communities, especially for things like marijuana that are illegal in places like Massachusetts, where white people are starting entire businesses while Black people are still in jail or prison for 10 years for possession.
Mm-hmm. And just really quickly, Erica, can I ask you where the data came from?
Oh, yeah, of course. Here, let me just pull up the name. The data came from County and State Arrest Data, NHDOS 2014. It's actually on our Instagram page if you'd like to look at the graphic.
No, what's the Instagram handle?
Our Instagram is BLM Manchester with only one M.
Okay. And James McKim, your thoughts on racial profiling in New Hampshire?
So as Erica pointed out, and as the chief pointed out, we know it exists. So we definitely want to address it. I think what we're talking about also points out, when we talk about arrest versus jail, there's a system here. It's not just about policing, it's also about the overall criminal justice system. So we also need to be talking here about the court system and the bias in the court system and how to eliminate the bias in the court system. We have people of color who are brought up in front of a judge and need to have bail. And we know that bail is being set higher for people of color. We know that when you get to the clerks for some of these sentencing and bringing your case to court, the whole bail system also needs to be examined. And so when we talk about training, I'm going to circle back to the training piece to this. There does need to be a lot more training, not just of the police force, but all along the path of the criminal justice system. And it starts with implicit bias. It goes from there to de-escalation training, but also, that's kind of attacking it's reactive. So we know that we're biased. How do we de-bias ourselves? There needs to be de-bias training in addition to the de-escalation training and desensitization training. So we don't have people making these judgments based on their implicit bias in the first place. Their implicit bias has changed.
Let's take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about police accountability and what it actually means to defund the police. We're hearing that a lot. We'll talk with our guests about what that means. And as always, we would love to hear from you on this. If you've got a question or a comment you'd like to make, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're talking about police reform. With me this hour, James McKim, president of the Manchester chapter of the NAACP, Erica Perez, co-founder of the Manchester chapter of Black Lives Matter, and Charlie Dennis, chief of Hanover Police and president of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. And we're talking with you as well. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to Madeline in Manchester. Madeline, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I was calling because I have mental illness in my family. My brother and my dad both had bipolar. And in the past, the police did not know how to handle that kind of situation with someone that was paranoid and afraid of them and fearful for their life. What I'm seeing now is that with drug addiction and with mental illness, all those things are tied together. And the police haven't been exposed to that enough and trained to be able to handle situations. There was abuse years ago, and we are not a colored family. We're French mm-hmm. and we live in a very small community where you know your neighbors and, you know, life is good. But when the mental illness comes in and you have people that do not know how to handle it, I think about the Addison,
Well, before we get too deep in the weeds, Madeline, I do want to put that to our guests today. So your point being that police are not equipped to handle mental health crises. Chief Charlie Dennis, would you agree with that?
We certainly have received a lot of training over the last several years in law enforcement dealing with those issues. And this kind of brings up kind of what Erica touched on earlier, too, of law enforcement finds themselves, we're the end all. There's not a call that comes in that we can't say, oh, we're not going to respond to that. We have to go. There's no one else to go. You have someone calling in requesting a call for service. Of maybe it's someone having a mental health crisis or emergency. So we don't have the opportunity to not to go. So we have to respond. We've been fortunate with critical incident training, which is a 40-hour class of how to deal with people in mental health crisis. It also speaks to de-escalation. Those are important trainings that law enforcement agencies are starting to get members within their organization trained in to help us respond better to those type of organizations. But I think there's some good topics coming up, certainly on the state and the national level of, is there more that can be done? Is there no difference than we had advocates on domestic violence type cases that can help on that end? Is there some other type workers that could come in and help us dealing with some of these mental health issues and crises? Because many times it's not the first time we've dealt with an individual. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we may be going out several times before maybe a serious incident happens. So anything we could do and get help to do things better on our end or have a collaborative effort dealing with some of those issues would be great for society.
Well, that's part of the question. I mean, if you have officers returning to someone experiencing a mental health crisis multiple times, does that not speak to the inability to help this person the first time?
Right. And we try to get people help. I mean, there's certain criteria that has to be met. Are they a danger to themselves or others before we can even, you know, take them to admission unless they're willing to self-commit themselves for a psychiatric evaluation. We work with family members. So we do what we can. We're just still limited in what we can do. And sometimes it's extremely frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Peter, can I jump in?
Certainly. Yes. Go ahead. James McKim.
So what larger cities at least have been able to do, and we have this in Manchester, police, as the chief said, have had training on dealing with mental health issues, but when they encounter a situation where there is a mental health issue, in Manchester, there's a special unit that the first responders can call in, and these are mental health experts who are trained how to address the situation. So that's some of the kinds of things that that are being done here in New Hampshire and other places. And unfortunately, smaller towns may not have the funding and resources to do that. So we need to figure a way, I think, to provide that kind of assistance, even for the smaller towns to address that.
And that has been, I'd like to go to Erica Perez next on this, because that has been what you described, James, one of the definitions of defund the police, move funding away from enforcement as we traditionally understand it and more towards, seems like maybe the mental health units that they have in Manchester that you were describing, James. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Erica. Can you tell us what you believe is meant by defund the police?
I think defund the police could mean three different things depending on who you're talking to. Defund the police could mean disband the police. Defund the police could mean defund the police completely. And then defund the police can also mean divest the money that goes into these bloated, like, police department budgets and put them in other places in the community. I know that in Manchester, our biggest budget is schools and not police, but in places like, you know, the LAPD has like a $3 billion police budget when their community is suffering. And I'm not saying that Manchester is like perfect, because it's not our first, like our most expensive budget either. But we don't spend $3 billion on the police. And that when people are calling to defund the police, it's because there's money to be put in other places and allocated better than that.
Mm-hmm. And so is that what you are advocating for?
I personally advocate for divesting some of the money and putting it in other places in the community, because statistics show that when you put money towards things like schools and programs and after school programs, supplies, mental health, addiction. Like, addiction is such a problem in New Hampshire, and addiction isn't a criminal issue, it's a health issue. And the disparities in mental health available to low-income communities, like, those are part of the reasons we have crime. People don't do crime because it's fun. Nobody does crime because it's fun.
Well, let me put that to Chief Charlie Dennis. What do you make of that idea that perhaps with money reallocated away from police departments and towards those programs that Erica Perez was describing would reduce the need for so many police officers in the first place? What do you think, Chief Dennis?
I think certainly there's the title is causing some of the issues. And I think that's what Erica talked a little bit about, too, if there's different interpretations of that. So I think just the title alone creates defensiveness on different sides. I think it's a community issue of sitting back and talking of, here's our budget. We all go through budget processes each year. We have to justify what we need and why we need it.
Yes, but could I just drill in really, really closely to that issue that she just described, taking some of the money that is traditionally allocated towards police and towards these other programs that may stop crime before it starts? Are you in support of an idea like that?
Again, I think that would be a case-by-case basis of each community looking at their police department, how the funding structured, is there extra money that could be taken away to do that, but at the same time, provide that agency the necessary funds to do additional trainings and different things like that, which are highlighted right now, too.
Mm-hmm. So, I know you can't speak for all communities, but you are chief of Hanover Police. What about Hanover?
Well, certainly they're welcome to look at my budget, and we make that determination. I know we're looking at making a community forum here in the next few months, and be happy to have that discussion.
James McKim of the Manchester NAACP, I know you've been working on putting together some recommendations, and I know that is an ongoing effort. I wanted to check in with you on where that stood right now.
Sure. So we've been in conversations with a number of folks from the state police to police chiefs locally to county police to working with various attorneys, with county attorneys, and really trying to gather input as to what all the stakeholders think could be done. And, you know, surprisingly, we've talked about many of the issues that are on our list so far. There are a few others with nuances that could each bear an hour conversation on their own. But we're hoping that, you know, this new governor's council, these recommendations, I'm certainly going to bring to that discussion and see what we can come up with from the state perspective, and whether, depending upon what comes up from those recommendations, we'll see what other kinds of actions we'll take from that.
Well, James McKim, president of the Manchester chapter of the NAACP, thank you very much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thanks also to Erica Perez, co-founder of the Manchester chapter of Black Lives Matter, and Chief Charlie Dennis, chief of Hanover Police and president of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. Thank you both very much. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is such a wide-ranging conversation. There were so many aspects of this question that we did not dive into to the depth I would have liked. We didn't talk about body cameras, for example. We didn't talk more broadly about the justice system overall. But hopefully the conversation will continue online at nhpr.org and on our Facebook page and on future shows here on The Exchange. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord and the engineer Dan Colgan. I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoi. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.